Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. The Chinese government is further extending its sovereignty over the internet. We'll discuss the ever smaller gap in China's Great Firewall. The U.S. isn't the only place with extremist issues. We'll hear how the far right has rebranded itself in Europe. And on Global Notes, our look at international music, flamenco music live from our studio from the Clannad Dance Flamingos Quartet Project. Don't forget, you can join the conversation on Twitter at WBEZ Worldview. China's beginning to enforce its new cybersecurity law. People in China who've needed to bypass China's online censorship known as the Great Firewall have traditionally used virtual private networks, VPNs. This allowed access to sites like Google, Facebook, and Twitter. But the cybersecurity law says that VPNs are no more. Apple pulled VPN apps from its app store. We're going to talk about this effect, the effect this is having on the people who are using VPNs with Yuan Yang, and she is a Financial Times economics and technology reporter in Beijing. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First of all, who is using VPNs in China? Of the many users of the internet, how many use VPNs?
Oh, it's very difficult to get a precise number because the nature of VPNs is that they keep you secret. And I would say that the government's very aware that a lot of people use VPNs. In particular, anyone who's been to university probably used a VPN while at university because it's necessary to access things like Google Scholar or do things academic, do academic research with the rest of the world. VPNs are really necessary. And I think most people who are what you might call middle class in a social sense in China are aware that there's a whole internet outside of China and are able to pay either a small amount of money to get access to a private VPN or might use more kind of DIY methods of making their own VPN. Yeah. So VPNs are very widespread. And I mean, the government censors are very aware of this. In fact, when I interviewed recently the ex chief censor, and he was just pointing to all the fact that many of the people he knew use VPNs. And so it's not a sustainable system.
So the censors' buddies use VPNs. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, there was a hilarious moment earlier this year where the creator of what we call the Great Firewall of China, which is this complex system of controls to keep out information that the government doesn't want and block information that's politically sensitive. The creator of this system was spotted using a VPN when he was giving a lecture, and it was projected up there on the lecture screen. So that was quite humiliating.
Okay, so and I imagine a lot of businesses actually need this. If you're a global international business, you would need this. Like the Financial Times bureau in Beijing probably needs this.
That's right. I mean, as a business, you would use this for two reasons. And one is basically privacy and security. If you didn't use a VPN, then any information I'm sending over the internet, unless it's already encrypted by another, say, like a mail program, will be liable to interception by anybody from, to somebody else on your Wi-Fi network to the government in China, who can very easily read your emails and your personal messages. So the first reason you'd use this as a business is privacy. You might be handling trade secrets or copyrighted information that you don't want people to access. And the second reason, of course, is to access all these international internet platforms, things like Google. If you use Gmail or Google Apps, you'll need to use a VPN even just to get into your email. So that's a really basic reason why you need to do this, just to link up with the rest of your international company. If you have somebody using, say, a Dropbox in the US, and you can't access that in China unless you've got a VPN. So it's really vital for many multinationals.
So what did everybody in your office do when their Apple phones just knocked out their VPNs the other day?
Right. So as you mentioned, Apple decided to take down many of the major VPNs that are used in China from its App Store a few weeks ago. And this has the effect of meaning that if I were to, say, lose my phone or get a new one, or if I needed to update my apps, I wouldn't be able to download those VPNs again. So, I mean, because the Financial Times is a large multinational, we have access to, you know, a whole IT system back in London who can create us personalized access to VPNs. And that's all really helpful for us. But for the many small and medium-sized enterprises who operate in China, or even if you're a large multinational but you're just starting to set up a China office, it's a big technical barrier to have to go into a country and set this up for your employees from scratch. I think that's why a lot of multinationals rely on these commercial VPN services, that so they don't have to do it themselves. So I think the primary effect on this is for those SMEs who don't have this, you know, IT support system back at headquarters, who can rig them up their own personalized workaround.
Now, the Chinese government knows you and other capable people are going to be able to do this. And they say they're going to give licenses to people so that it is okay to use VPNs. Do you still have to get a license if you have rigged things up with headquarters?
Right. So I think the government would certainly say, and this is clear in the laws, that it's taking down of VPNs is not meant to affect business operations. Although, of course, you get a lot of collateral damage because, you know, as with the internet, as with many other things that the government tries to regulate, it can't regulate very precisely. And so it tends to take out a whole chunk of internet activity that it doesn't want to take out every time it does what is often quite kind of rough-handed censorship. So what is legal is having having what they call a direct line to your company headquarters. It's not clear whether it's legal to use that for just surfing the web, or whether you can only use that for liaising with your headquarters, strictly speaking. And then if you have a VPN service where the VPN companies manage to acquire a special license from the government, that is also legal. But the VPN service is technically meant to keep a record of every single user that it's signed up to its service, and also make that available to the government, which certainly is not something that happens right now.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. I'm speaking with Yuan Yang, and she's a Financial Times economics and technology reporter in Beijing. And we're talking about the new cybersecurity law in China. They're cracking down on VPNs, virtual private networks, the way that people bypass the Great Firewall in China. Now, it would seem like the Chinese government, it would behoove it to be kind of loose with the licensing on this and make it easy for people to get a license so that the search for VPNs don't go underground. Because if you've got an Android phone, you can go out there and people can make their own VPNs and start selling apps, and you can have an underground economy of these things. It's like, from what I understand, a cat and mouse game, really.
Right. Well, it's interesting you mentioned the underground VPNs, or perhaps what I would just call the do-it-yourself VPNs, because technically speaking, if you have access to a machine with an internet connection outside of China, you can set that up to be a server, and you can set that up to be a VPN server. And then all you need to do is connect that to your laptop or your phone in China, and you're ready to go. And that's not something that I think the government looks kindly upon, and that's evidenced recently by the fact that they've been going quite hard after many of the web programmers and the developers who are making these DIY kits, which have the advantage of being open source and also often free to use. So I know that there have been developers in the web programming community who've been harassed by police, often, you know, tailed to their flats and so on, which is a really intimidating thing to happen to you. So the government is going after the underground, or, you know, the open source community as well. But back to your question as to the government's intentions on this. I mean, the government is between a rock and a hard place. It wants to have this quite thoroughgoing control of people's access to the internet and access to information on the one hand, and that's the authoritarian streak in the Communist Party. On the other hand, it wants to be open to business and a friendly place for multinationals to prosper and help China become richer and trade with China. And there are many points at which those two things are just simply going to clash, and I think this is one of them.
Well, Is this a temporary thing where a lot, almost every article I picked up read and said, well, this is all about the Party Congress, and after the Party Congress, they'll let up a little bit, and it won't be, the clash won't be so painful for people who use these things. It'll go back to kind of what it was.
Right, right. I think there's some truth in that, but I think there are two parts of the story. One is, as you point out, this cyclical element. Every 5 years, there's the Party Congress. People get really scared before the Congress. The government tightens a lot, and that's because of the transition of power that happens during each Congress. So there's some truth to the fact that, it's especially intense now. The censorship and the controls are especially intense because of the Congress, which is coming up in the autumn. I think there's a second part to that, though, which is a kind of structural issue, which is long term, which is that the government and Xi Jinping in particular, the president, has been really keen to fortify the legal system and the government with agencies and laws that make it more possible to control people's use of the internet. So Xi has made it a goal to make sure that the kinds of surveillance that he's afraid of, such as, say, the surveillance by the U.S. government, which was revealed by Edward Snowden, is not possible in China. And that's a fear of, foreign threats, foreign governments like the U.S. government, but also of, domestic threats or commercial threats like hacking in China. And so they've really ramped up the government agencies and, in fact, founded a new agency to oversee cyberspace security. So I think there is an element in which is structural and long-term, which is that China is going to be increasingly tightening and enforcing its control over the internet in the coming years, even after the Congress is over.
As a global leader in things now, does that not bode well for the rest of the world? I notice Russia's doing about the same thing with VPNs right now, and it could be a global trend to crack down on these things.
I think the good part of this story is that China didn't have, let's say, the best approach to cybersecurity. There are all these stories about outdated versions of Windows XP being used by government enterprises, right? And now with the cybersecurity law, at least there's a concerted push to get people to, patch and upgrade and make sure that there are more secure than they were. And that's a good thing, because anybody who does business with a Chinese enterprise should be assured that after the passing of the cybersecurity law, there's going to be more cybersecurity in China. So I think there's a positive element of this. I think the negative element is that for multinationals who want to do business with China, from Apple to Google or Facebook, they've all been trying to get back into the Chinese market, which is huge, for years. I think the negative part is that those multinationals will find themselves being increasingly asked to compromise what the kinds of values or the kinds of ideals they might have to do with privacy they might be asked to compromise those values increasingly as China ramps up its control over cybersecurity. And I think we're seeing that already with the way that American tech firms are engaging with China.
And so Apple has pretty much already done the deed, right? I mean, they pulled all the VPN apps from the App Store, and apparently China told them, you must comply, and Apple always says, we comply by the rules of the country that we're in, and they sell hardware. They want to sell hardware. They're not like Google, who can kind of blow it off.
I think this is a very difficult area, because in China, as with in any jurisdiction, there is the law, and then there's also how the government enforces and interprets that law, and how people actually behave. And I think in this case, the United Nations wrote to Apple, in fact, to ask them whether they were asked specifically by the government to take down these apps, or was this a proactive step on their part? And Apple have yet to send that reply back. But I think every tech firm operating in China, especially the domestic Chinese tech firms, are playing this game of second-guessing the government. They want to make sure that they're on the good side of the regulators. And that doesn't mean waiting until you get told off. That means trying to figure out if you're going to get told off and then doing what you think is the right thing beforehand. So this kind of anticipatory censorship happens a lot in China, and I think it will increasingly happen with the multinationals who engage with China.
So, I mean, Apple is still in there and really wants to sell phones there, I imagine. But Google and Twitter are out, and I can't imagine that they can get back in. There's Chinese alternatives to these things now that are well used, and I'm not sure they would want to take the censorship hits.
Sure. I mean, I think that all these multinationals, especially Google, have a lot to offer China. But you're right, there have been big domestic competitors who've grown up in the time that those American rivals have been shut out of China. And I would say that there's evidence to suggest that those domestic equivalents or alternatives have become more interesting and, in fact, more sophisticated than their Western equivalents. Take Tencent, one of China's tech giants, and its social messaging app, WeChat. Now, WeChat is the kind of app that you might compare to, say, Facebook or WhatsApp, but it's a lot more than those. It's almost a whole universe within an app. You can make mobile payments, you can book train tickets within the app, as well as send your friends your photos and so on. And it's so total as an app that you almost don't need to spend any time outside of it if you're in China on your mobile phone. So the equivalents that China have developed are, I would say, it's not right to think of them as just, oh, the Facebook of China or the Twitter of China. They're actually very different in function. And I would say much more interesting than their Western equivalents at this point.
All right. So censorship is good for anti-monopoly stuff. It's good for innovation.
Well, it's interesting. I would say that all major developed economies have had some point protected their infant industries during their early stages of development. Britain did it with the wool industry, back in the pre-industrial revolution era. You can see that the Asian tigers, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and now China have to some extent done that same protection of industries. And I think it can be an important step to development, as the economist Ha-Jun Chang has written about. I would say that keeping the American tech giants out of China has given rise to a really interesting kind of like new ecosystem within China. Like, it's let a new set of programs and devices flourish that probably wouldn't be the case if China had just become like a clone of the American tech world.
Well, it gets complicated, doesn't it?
That's right. I would say come to Beijing and spend some time messing around with your smartphone here.
Okay. Well, only if I can get a VPN from the Financial Times. Otherwise, I'm not coming.
Yeah, you can borrow mine.
Yuan Yang is a Financial Times economics and technology reporter in Beijing. Thanks a lot for talking to us about the crackdown on VPNs in China.
Thanks, Drew.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear about Europe's version of the alt-right. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. After the violent demonstrations in Charlottesville, Americans have been thinking about racism and xenophobic social movements. As much as it seems these alt-right movements are intensifying, this isn't just an American problem. Let's look at the rise of the alt-right in Europe. Instead of the term alt-right, similar ideologies in Europe call themselves identitarians. They've organized groups that are unafraid to talk about the need for national borders and cultural differences. They fear Islamization in their countries and calls for immigrants to be returned home, and wherever that home may be. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse met with some of them in Austria and France.
What What on earth is going on in Europe? Governments falling to populist revolts. Old certainties crumbling at a dizzying pace. A union based on half a century of stability is metamorphosing. But into what? This has been a year of centrifugal forces, of mainstream politics moving towards the fringes, and of fringe groups battling to lay claim to a new centre. We've come to Vienna, once the capital of a great empire. Today, Austria is on the periphery of world events, but we're here to meet some people who want to make Austria great again. They call themselves Die Identitäre Bewegung, or the Identitarian Movement. And they hold views which many would consider beyond the boundaries of the acceptable.
I would really ask you not to film the way there.
You don't want us to film the way in.
Yeah,
okay, so we'll switch off.
I'm sorry, but I'll tell him when he can start to film.
Yeah. Okay, fine, we'll switch off for now.
I'm sorry, yeah.
No problem.
You are
up here. But the parameters of public discourse are shifting.
Can we film from here? Or?
This is a group that's in the process of coming out of the shadows.
Fortunately, we have now some young members who are very affiliated with the media, cutting videos, internet and so on.
Yeah.
At the moment, we're even on the way to develop an app.
Right. Seriously.
Yeah. It's an app for Patriots where you can find the other guys who also have this app, you know?
Right. Like a sort of dating app.
But, yeah, like but a Tinder for Patriots.
Tinder for Patriots.
No, but it's
absolutely something that happens.
The Identitarians are, in some ways, different from the traditional far right.
I think it will not
they disavow violence. They're articulate and tech-savvy. They've got their own TV studio here.
Markus, alles klar haben.
They broadcast live with fellow travellers in other European countries and put together videos of their publicity stunts. Earlier this month, they scaled a statue of the Habsburg Empress Maria Theresa and dressed her up in a giant burqa. No prizes then for guessing their views on Islam and immigration.
That those people who came here illegally, yeah, now during the refugee crisis, they need to be sent back home. That's very important because.
But they can't be sent back home. You'd be sending them into a war zone.
No. A lot of them didn't come from Syria to begin with, and for the others, I think we should create zones and areas around Europe. Like,
you know, that's got like really scary overturns, especially in this part
then,
of the
then
world.
You have to
put zones and areas
but,
where you put people that has. You, like, there's
you
another
know,
word for that.
I think. I think. No, no.
Safe zones.
Yeah.
The official plan of the United Nations also to create a safe zone.
That you automatically made this association is also showing part of the problem because a lot of Europeans, you know, have conditioned in a way when they hear some words like people, like culture. Like border, you know, like identity, or being proud of oneself, immediately kind of an ethnomasochistic reflex kicks in, yeah, and creates this Nazi reflex, you know, and people are really fed up with that.
Yeah.
We left their TV studio and moved on to a local cafe. If they're not Nazis, I wondered, then what are they? I ran them through a checklist of typical far-right issues.
How do you feel about people from different ethnic backgrounds marrying, having children?
Their choice.
Their choice. You're cool with it. You're cool with it. How do you feel about gay people?
Also their choice.
Their choice.
Personal choice.
Yes. Have you got gay friends?
Not that I would know of.
Right. Do you think that's odd that you don't have any gay friends?
I don't have any.
But do you think it's odd in that you don't have any?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, fine. What about Jews?
Yeah. No problem.
You don't think Jews are running the world in a secret conspiracy?
No. Ironically, it's the Jews that are most worried about Islamization of Europe right now. We have a huge exodus from France, for instance. Jews are fleeing Europe because of Islamization.
And so the conversation turns back to Muslim immigration. Islamophobia is the new anti-Semitism, and the Identitarians see themselves as part of a broader cultural insurgency.
We are a European movement. We exist in France, we exist in Germany, Austria, Italy, we exist in Slovenia, we exist in the Czech Republic. And we are overcoming old-style nationalism, chauvinistic nationalism, which are attacking other European countries. We think we have a European culture, and today, in the 21st century, we need to stick together.
And we want a Europe that maintains the national differences, that secures our borders, that is strong in the outside, but soft and pluralistic in the inside. Hmm. And this union is complete. Is exactly the opposite.
Would you like Austria to leave the European Union?
I don't think that at the moment we need to talk about it, because Austria is getting strong. Brexit was a huge wake-up call. In France, we have patriotic change. We have the Visegrad states. I think we can take over this whole system and turn it into a real Europe.
You think you can take it over?
I think we can, and we will.
Time for a reality check. Austria's identitarian movement has only a few hundred activists. Voters rejected the candidate from the far-right Freedom Party, albeit by a narrow margin. But it's not just Austria. Across Europe, right-wing populist parties are challenging the old duopoly of the centre-right and the centre-left. Nowhere is that challenge more stark than in France, where the ideas of the identitarian movement are supported by a growing number of influential public intellectuals.
Well, I'm on my way now to meet one of these people who provides the intellectual underpinnings for the identitarians here in France. He's a man who was once a senior advisor to former President Nicolas Sarkozy.
Patrick Buisson sees the old European order facing a revolt by a younger generation who are beginning to reject the whole post-war Western consensus.
Cette génération a vu à travers le libéralisme pas simplement sa dimension économique, mais sa dimension culturelle, et a pensé que le libéralisme était insécable, indissociable, qu'il y avait une unité philosophique du libéralisme, qu'on ne pouvait pas séparer le libéralisme économique du libéralisme sociétal et culturel.
And in this worldview, Brexit was a tipping point.
Vous ne pouvez pas imaginer ce qu'a décidé le peuple britannique au mois de juin peut avoir d'importance pour les continentaux comme nous, Français, puisque c'est la démonstration que le peuple redevient, à travers le vote du Brexit, un sujet politique, c'est-à-dire capable de décider de son destin là où on veut décider de son destin, à sa place.
Scarred by recent terrorist attacks, France is increasingly preoccupied by the existential question of what it means to be French. In Lyon, as in other cities, people are leading increasingly segregated lives. And as the dream of multiculturalism loses its shine, the politics of identity is gaining ground. Génération Identitaire have their headquarters in a bar down one of the city's medieval side streets. They call themselves not activists, but militants, and claim to have 2,000 fee-paying members in more than a dozen cities across France. Twice a week, they fan out across the city, distributing hot soup and winter clothes to the homeless, or to the European homeless, as they put it.
On demande quelque chose de chaud, on lui donnera. Mais voilà, comme je vous le dis, nous, on a fait un choix, c'est d'aider les nôtres avant les autres.
In the summers, they organise youth camps where they train and exchange ideas with other like-minded people from across Europe, including Martin Selner, the Austrian we met earlier. Génération Identitaire are not directly affiliated with any political party. Their rejection of multiculturalism goes further than a proposal to simply limit immigration. What they're proposing is, in effect, ethnic cleansing.
D'aller dans un pays dont ils se sentent un peu plus investis.
They're French. They're as French as you are. They were born here.
Oui, ce sont des Français de papier. Ce qu'on appelle un Français de papier. C'est pas un Français de culture. C'est pas un Français qui a la même mode de vie. C'est un citoyen. Il a une carte d'identité. À ce titre-là, ça n'en fait pas un Français de façon concrète. Si lui-même crache sur la France, si lui-même crache sur l'Europe, si lui-même commet des délits, c'est qu'il n'a pas envie d'être là, on lui propose tout simplement d'être ailleurs.
Again, perspective. The more extreme views of the identitarians are not echoed, officially at least, even by the kaleidoscope of far-right parties now vying for the centre ground in France, the Netherlands and Belgium, in Italy, Germany and Austria. Martin Selner and his friends are a small minority. But the thing is, they know that.
In fact, we see ourselves in patriotic avant-garde, who is pushing the envelopes, the overtone window of what you can say and what you can think.
Little by little, these ideas are being fed into the political bloodstream. Not new ideas, but old ones. Ideas that many thought had been consigned to history.
That was the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse talking with identitarians in Austria and France. I hope you're looking forward to the big event on Monday. The moon is going to blot out the sun, and the long-awaited eclipse will be here, and it's actually happening during this program. We are going to devote the show to the eclipse that day, and one of the things we want to do to psych up during the show is play stories of people who've experienced a total eclipse. We are accumulating total eclipse stories on our hotline at 888-915-2270. If you have seen a total eclipse before and have a great eclipse story, we would like to hear it on this hotline number, 888-915-2270. Tell us what it was like, where you were, what you saw, and we'll play it on the show on Monday. Hope you can listen and enjoy the eclipse with us here on Worldview. Coming up after the break, we hope you'll stay with us and enjoy some flamenco music. We're going to have some terrific flamenco music here in the studio. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for Global Notes, our look at international music. Tony Sarabia is here, the host of Morning Shift and Radio M. Nice to see you, Tony.
Hey, Jerome.
So this is fun. We've got flamenco music live in the studio.
Flamenco music and flamenco dance. And I don't know if you remember when that documentary came out about the Roma tradition and the migration from musicians and folks from India and how they traveled to certain parts of Eastern Europe, but also Spain. And a lot of people say that's part of the Roma tradition, flamenco music. I read somewhere that the tradition dates back to the mid-18th century. But over that time, we've seen so many changes and it's evolved so much. Well, my understanding is this group really casts aside some of those old traditions, but keeps a well enough foundation that you know it's flamenco, but really takes us in different places.
It's a global music now.
Yeah.
We're going to hear from the flamenco quartet of the Clenard Dance Group, and they're performing Sunday, August 20th at the National Museum of Mexican Art. They've got a lot of people performing with them. This group that we're going to hear from now is going to take up half the bill. And Wendy Clenard is here, and she's going to dance, and I'm looking forward to it. Let's hear the first tune. Thank you.
Chole, mi niño, olé, que un cachito de pan, ay, ay, que un cachito de pan. Si hace su calatira y luego la va a molar, ay, ay, y luego la va a molar. Ay, le, 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 cachito de pan, ay, le, 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 cachito de pan, ay, le, 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 cachito de pan.
Yeah, that's excitement. We don't have that much fun in this studio usually. Come on over here, Wendy. You must be exhausted.
Well,
I can't believe that. It was so dramatic.
You know, it's great because I mentioned that movie. I can't remember if it was called... Well, no, it was Where the Road Ends. And it brought a bunch of... I think it was Rajasthan Express was part of the bill. A woman, older woman, Spanish woman, and her musicians... And then the famous Roma band with the violin player who used to pull one of his violin strings. Yes. And
Steve knows that trick.
Well, that was really like Roma meets España in this tune right here. Yeah, you can really hear the connections.
Wendy Clenard is here. Clenard Dances Flamenco Quartet Project is going to be at the National Museum of Mexican Art on Sunday, August 20th, 3 p.m. You can see him there. You've been doing this flamenco stuff for a while, Wendy.
For a long while, yep.
Tell us about Clenard Dance.
Well, formally we were founded in 1999, and it was really a platform to use flamenco as a vocabulary to create content-driven work. So, it, like ballet, has been repurposed and reinvented with so many different intentions. I thought, can't we do that with flamenco? And then that would allow me to draw from the Chicago community of artists. So I could work with a sculptor, a painter, a video artist, a writer, Steve, or, you know, having unique instruments. And then what it is in the end, it's okay, whatever that becomes. But we know that flamenco is the sort of root vocabulary to that.
I was going to say, you certainly don't break away from what people know as the sound of flamenco, the beautiful guitar playing and singing from Maria Temo, Javier Somay on the caja, sometimes called the cajon, right? Of course, the great Steve Gibbons on violin.
Yeah, you
so
know, I would make
know what they're hearing, right?
A real clear distinction that it's not fusion in any way, shape, mm-hmm. or form, and that and one thing I'd like to really shout out to Marie about is she accompanied a wonderful old school singer for many years, Manuela Leiva, and she sings and she dances, and she's taken many years to really dissect what is this flamenco structure about, this interplay between dance and guitar and singer. And because she knows that so well, we're able to say, well, if we don't have a singer, could it be a piece of text by John Steinbeck?
Oh, wow.
Could that be the handoff moment? Or could it be a visual of you know, we did a piece about the Chicago River. Could it be this animated ink drawings that starts to sort of create texture and visual energy, and then can that hand off into the guitar? So, and it's not random. Mm-hmm. You know, the structure for me is one of the golden pieces of flamenco, which makes us get the goose pimples and things like that, because of those proportions. She goes, I go, you go, we go together.
But there still is some improvisation, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think if that, to the point, if you know the structure, then you really can improvise without it seeming random.
I enjoyed the percussion duo there with your feet and the cajon there. Mm-hmm. That was really cool.
Yeah, so we'll explore, like, what's the capacity for just the pure feet? What's it, the feet and caja? What is it all together? And that sort of, we're always looking for finding, you know, textures and dynamics within that.
Are musicians in España taking chances like this, or reinventing it like this? Or is this kind of unique to places outside of Spain?
Well, I would say, you know, you bow to them, you know, they're the kings and queens sure. of it. I would say their experience is very different. I mean, my name's Wendy Clenard. How flamenco is that? I mean, I try to be very transparent about, you know, having a dedicated practice, but, you know, finding what does that mean in the landscape I live in, musically, politically, socially, and all of that sort of thing. So when I go to Spain and I study, they're like, oh, that's so cool. That's really cool. And, oh, I have an accent when I speak Spanish. That's cool. Like, they like it when you don't try, you know, you're really bringing something to it that's different and sincere. And I think that's been really helpful. Because I teach a lot. I have a school about 16 years old in Pilsen. And a lot of times in the beginning, students are coming to add something to themselves, right, to take away from something that's bothering them. I'm going to add. I'm going to have this new identity. I'm going to be a flamenco dancer. I'm going to have a cool dress. But it's on the contrary, totally. I mean, for me anyway, I'll speak. It's taking away and taking away mm-hmm. and taking away.
So the project that you're doing on Sunday at the National Museum of Mexican Art, it's going to be half a concert by you guys, the people we just heard.
That's right.
And then half students and
these
other
lovely,
people.
Lovely, 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 if they're listening, so lovely students who have worked so hard this summer. We see each other almost every evening. And yeah, so in the age-wise runs the gamut. I have a little person, 5 years old, all the way to about 65
years old.
That's
got to be cute.
Wow.
So we have this just a really nice spectrum generation, and all kinds of folks from all different neighborhoods will be part of that.
Can I quickly ask a question about the singing, because your voice is so emotive, and there's almost like a certain sound to flamenco singing. How do you describe that style of singing, and how do you learn it? Your mic is on, I believe. Oh.
Well, I personally, being a foreigner, not raised in Spain, studied imitating recordings, and that took some practice to really learn the sounds and the qualities of that are represented in the flamenco style. But I have to say, as I've matured through this business and I continue to grow, the sounds that you imitate, you have to bring from within oneself and connect with some kind of pain, happiness, combinations of many emotions to bring that sound forward. And we try to have that flamenco style, but you end up developing your own within the style because you bring that forward from yourself. But it is technically the vocal techniques are very guttural or throaty, yeah, and kind of haunting in style. But the style has changed a bit over through the years. It can be much more light and airy or very deep. Deep cante hondo, they call. There's different gamuts of the representation of the characters or characteristic style, but I personally I find it just an interesting journey. As I was classically trained, I had a minor in voice, and I took those techniques and applied them to flamenco, so I would not hurt myself. It's very rough on the chord, the vocal cords.
Yeah, you really belted it out there.
Yeah, right.
Like, you jumped right in.
Right. So just kind of morphing classical training and making it into flamenco sound has been my way, and I share that with many students and master classes to get them to understand the same principles.
Beautiful. Maria Temo on guitar and vocals here, and I'd love to hear more from the Clenard Dances Flamenco Quartet project. What's the next tune we'll play out here? And I'll just tell people what's on the show tomorrow, the Sonia Shaw Organization. We'll talk about India Fest Milwaukee. We'll have a good time. And Steve Bynum and Julian Haida produced this program. Mike Gilmore and Daniel Musisi engineered. We are Facebooking live this next tune, so if you wanted to go on Facebook and watch the dancing and the singing and the playing, it's happening on Facebook at WBEZ Worldview. Okay, Wendy, what are we going to hear?
Sure, this next piece is based on a traditional form called Faruka. Maria composed this, and we have Steve as the cante, as the voice. So the violin will be our singer.
All right. Thank you.
Si hace su canastilla y luego